listeners to this episode of Fat Girl Book Club. For this episode, we read the book Big, Stories About Life in Plus-Size Bodies, edited by Christina Myers. That might be burying the lead a little bit. This discussion is not my regular format. As you know, normally I talk to people who did not write the book about a body acceptance book. Normally this is someone in the body acceptance spaces doing something, photography or coaching, an artist, something that's in that body acceptance space. But this time, this is so special. I am talking to some of the authors of this anthology. I think it's really important that we listen to people who are in larger bodies about their experiences. These are the people who are going to tell us how difficult it is to move around in the current world in the bodies that they're in. This can give us good indications of where we need to focus our time and efforts in order to make the world more inclusive. Often, and a lot of the books even on this podcast, for the most part, are nonfiction books that discuss things like healing your relationship to food, or even talking about these issues that have to do with inclusivity in more of a detached manner, giving us facts and figures, telling us things that we need to be aware of. But this book is very special because it is people in plus size bodies talking about what it means to them on a day-to-day level to go out into the world in the bodies that they're in. It's important work. It's hard work. It can be healing work. And this episode is my discussion, the kind of little mini conversations that I had with four different authors from this anthology. So before I really get into my first guest and kind of get into this format, I just want to take a really brief amount of time and tell you about something I'm really excited about. So for a really, really, really long time, I have been working on an online program called How to Stop Hating What You See in the Mirror. It's gone through so many revisions and there's so much going on with it that it's taken me a very long time to actually hit publish. But now my friends, it is available for pre-order. So we'll be starting on July the 5th. This is a great course if you are thinking that maybe you want to start on a journey to body acceptance, but you're not really quite sure how. Or you are a chronic dieter and you're looking to get off that roller coaster, you're just not sure how to do that. Or you're living in a larger body and it's very uncomfortable for you to look in the mirror or put on clothes or get on a scale and you're feeling really down about your body. These are all good reasons to check out this course. With the course, you will get a 35-page workbook with a whole whack load of exercises in it. You'll get 14 different lessons. Each of these lessons have at least one video, if not two. And there's bonus material that includes blog posts and extra exercises and journaling prompts to kind of push things to that next level. There'll also be 6 scheduled Zoom calls where we can go over material in the course. Now, the really great thing about checking this out now is that it's introductory pricing. I know that these exercises are amazing because this is what I use to heal myself and put me on a path to body acceptance. So I know they're helpful, but I want to make sure that the structure and the way I have set it up is going to work, which is why my pricing is super low. So if you have any interest, if any of this sounds interesting to you, please jump over to the website, iwishiwereme.com. And click on the online course tab, and that will take you to more information. You can get the entire course outline, and there's information on how to purchase there. Okay, that being said, let's get back to this episode. So first I want to tell you how I've set this up. So each of the people I'm going to be talking to, I sent them an email that asked them four different questions that I said I was going to bring up when we had these chats. Now, as you're going to hear, we didn't always get to all these questions. We often went off into other places. So this structure is definitely not the exact structure of every single one of these conversations, but this is the information that I gave them originally. So I told them I was going to ask them what their relationship to their body was like before they wrote their piece for the anthology. I told them I was going to ask them what the process of writing about their body, did it change anything in terms of how they thought about or treated their body? I told them I was going to ask them what their current relationship is to their body, and I was going to ask them if they have a tip to help people connect to their bodies. Again, these conversations did not always follow this format. In fact, we went off into spaces I never dreamed we would go into, but I'm so excited that we did. Just a quick note that I didn't ask any of them for any contact information while we were recording. So if you want to contact any of these authors, if you're interested in more of their work, I have some contact information in the show notes. So go there to find out anything more about these authors. Okay, with that, I am going to introduce you to my very first author. We are going to be talking to Jen Arbo. And here is her bio. Jen Arbo lives with her family in New Westminster, BC, where she works in the public sector. She holds a blue belt in karate, prefers to shoot her recurve bow sightless, and cans a great jar of jam, though she swears she is not preparing for a dystopian future. Likes snug socks, strong tea, and a brand new dot grid journal. Dislikes heights, clutter, and storage containers that have lost their matching lids. Encircled is her first published piece since her son was born and stole her brain a decade ago, and she's happy to be back. And with that, please enjoy my little mini conversation with Jen Arbo. Hi, Jen. Welcome to Fat Girl Book Club.
Hi, Jen. I'm so glad to be here. This is great.
We are talking about this really, really great book that there was so many contributors to it, and you were one of them. And before we get into your story that's actually here, let's start with a little bit about what your relationship to your body was like before you wrote this piece for the anthology.
Yeah, it's an awesome question. I was very ambivalent about myself, and I treated myself and my body as something that wasn't actually me. It was something I was sort of witnessing that it was, you know, was occurring. I think things started transforming for me when I had a child and I was pregnant and I was celebrated for being this very large person, and people were, you know, rubbing my belly and expressing how healthy my baby was. And I started realizing that maybe it was okay, the shape and size that my body was. And maybe, you know, this relationship I'd had for so many years was actually incorrect. And I was thinking back to a memory of my brother getting married, and I was one of his groom's people, and I was wearing a tuxedo, and there's this photo of me where I was like reaching up and I was curling my hair as we did in the 90s. And I was curling my hair in a way where I was like sort of making that garden weasel thing happening. And the way I was reaching up, my top had come up just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking back on this photo and thinking to myself, and really honing, not like the happy memory of my brother getting married, but really thinking about the fact that I was horrified at my size. And now when I look at that photo, I'm like, my image of myself was very... skewed. And I really clearly didn't understand the person I was. And I was very outside of myself. And so my relationship before writing this was very different. But I think the catalyst ultimately became being pregnant and having a baby.
Mm. So when you sat down to write this, how many years difference was there between having a baby and writing this story that you wrote for this anthology?
So probably 12 years. My son turns 13 this year. And I have always considered myself to be a writer. And that's kind of a bit of a loaded word for a lot of people. I think it's important for a lot of people to understand that they are a writer in the sense of like success and having had things published. But also, I'd always considered myself to be a communicator and a writer. So I've long published blogs about parenting and long published things that really sort of celebrated and highlighted different aspects of my life or my thoughts or feelings or opinions. So for me, it was a long time between kind of having that revelation. And it wasn't until the editor, Christina Myers, put out that kind of call for people to write something. And I felt this like little tweak of like, I have a thing to say. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but I have a thing to say. So I wrote the piece specifically for the anthology, specifically for submission to the anthology. And, you know, when you have a baby, I think many parents will find that the first half dozen years are so overwhelming. Your kid is on you 24/7. You don't get the opportunity to, like, you know, pursue some of your hobbies. And even if you try to, your brain's still occupied with other aspects. So it hasn't been until my child's become a little bit more independent that I really felt I had the opportunity to like literally close the door and be like, okay, I'm going to write tonight. Tonight is my writing night. So you guys find something else to do. Whereas, you know, when they're 2 or 3 years old, you can't do that because they tend to light the house on fire or hurt themselves or eat something they're not supposed to or harass right. the dog. So I kind of felt like I finally had headspace to actually sit down and kind of analyze. And part of writing is just sitting and thinking and sitting and kind of working through some of your own feelings and figuring out a way to describe those feelings. So it took me a long time to get there. So yeah, 12 years-ish, but at the same time, I feel like it may have opened a floodgate.
Right. So sitting down and then this is what came out, and it's a beautiful piece that you wrote. Can you talk a little bit about your piece and what it was about, and then maybe also the process of actually getting, because it doesn't sound like there was any kind of chaos going on in your head. It sounds very much like you had this very well thought out thought process. So if that was the first time you'd actually kind of put this down on paper, that's really, really incredible. So, because if you could talk a little bit about that, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. So my piece is called Encircled, and it is a little bit of a reflection, somewhat, you know, self-deprecating, somewhat humorous, which is often how I navigate a lot of the things in my life that I find really challenging. But it is really about my love-hate relationship with belts, which is, you know, it seems like such an innocuous piece in your wardrobe. And I think a lot of people have belts. But, you know, one thing I've learned is that, and from having written this piece and having it published and had people kind of come back to me and sort of provide me with feedback about their personal experience, which I love, is that I'm not alone and that belts are complicated and that pants manufacturers don't do a good job of like preparing your body to hold a belt up. And if you're the wrong shape, they just slide off of you. And so I find it a frustration and many kind of fast fashion, especially, but also some fashion houses, they just don't understand that that bodies come in really different and diverse shapes. And so belts are really hard. For me, I started realizing that over the course of my life of like being sort of an adult who dressed myself, you know, I had all these different belts in my life that I wore because I thought they were fashionable. And when I stopped wearing them, I started feeling a lot better about the shape that I was, the fact that they didn't stay up and that nothing sort of slid down my frame. And so my piece was really important for me to highlight the idea of Ouroboros, which is this, I mean, there's a couple of different schools of thought of Ouroboros, but Ouroboros is essentially an old symbol that symbolizes the world. It is the snake eating its own tail. It is this birth and death and rebirth and, you know, death again, this very cyclical kind of piece. And I feel like in a lot of women's lives, that is a really important part of how we identify our bodies and how we kind of see what's important to us. Because it takes a while to get the message. You know, it takes a little while for us to sort of clue in and go, oh, okay, actually, I don't mind myself. I'm pretty good with this. This is good, because I didn't feel that way earlier. And it wasn't until I kind of realized the importance of really diving into like what's actually the issue here? Like what's making you uncomfortable? Is it the fashion magazines? Is it all these people who tell you that you need to have a belt to be put together? Or is it just that they make you uncomfortable physically and they make you feel like it's not yourself? And so maybe it is more a taking back of your own identity to be able to say, you know what, I don't need your stupid fashion rule and I'm not going to wear your belt. So
yes,
stick it.
Well, and I mean, I know for me, it was like at some point, I'm not really quite sure when, late 30s somewhere, I went, I don't give a shit so much about what I'm looking like to other people. If I'm uncomfortable, then it's not helping anyone because I can't, I'm too distracted by pulling up my pants and feeling this horrible thing at my stomach and, you know, trying to work with the dangly earrings or whatever it is that I put on in order to make myself feel like I'm fitting in and belonging. And it's just like, I just got to walk away from this. I can't do this.
Yeah. I've got, you know, there's a certain fabric that some shirts are made in nowadays that's like not really breathable. And for my job, I occasionally have to sort of dress up a little bit kind of fancy where I feel obliged to. I don't necessarily, right. I've not been told, but I feel a little bit obliged to.
For sure.
It's like you walk in the door and you're like, take it off me. I'm sweaty and I feel clammy and it is the worst feeling possible. Please get it off my skin and like give me a nice cotton t-shirt that moves and breathes with me.
Exactly.
I don't need to be my clothing's enemy. I need to be friends with the clothes that I wear to cover my body.
Exactly. And that's a tough one too, right? Because there's so much privilege involved with being able to just buy clothes that fit.
Yeah, there's, and especially in plus size clothing, which is all over the map. I mean, I ordered a pair of shorts in preparation for, you know, hot girl summer. I ordered a pair of shorts and they're actually a size larger than I technically would take. Mm-hmm. And they arrived today and I put them on and I'm like, okay, this is ridiculous. This is not the size that I thought it was. Mm-hmm. And I'm disappointed in this and I'm frustrated by this. And I have the privilege of doing that. But I mean, for years, I thrifted my clothes for a long time. Yep. I played around with the idea of making my own clothes and altering clothes, which worked for a long time. But now like even fabric is expensive. And so for plus size clothing and for people who wear plus sizes, there is a whole market of people who are gifting within their friend group and sort of like, oh, these don't fit me anymore. Do you want them? A long time ago, I made the observation that a lot of clothing for women, especially, or people who identify as women, it goes to the thrift shop when it's worn out. And it's, you know, it's out of fashion and it's got a stain when it's plus size. If you're a smaller person, it's a different story. You might just decide you don't need it anymore because clothing feels more accessible. Yes. But for plus size women, especially and people who identify as a plus size woman, it is really hard to find thrifted clothes. And so the sort of the cycle keeps kind of digging into people. Yeah. So in my story, one of the things I talk about is that I have a belt that I found at a thrift shop. Yeah. It's not a special belt. It's actually a belt from a baseball uniform. and it's, you know, it's kind of one of those things where I picked it up and it was actually from the men's section of a thrift shop. And I picked it up and I wear it and it's bright orange and it's terribly ugly. And it's the only belt that actually functions the way a belt is meant to function.
Exactly.
So.
Well, and I love how you talk about the belt that your mom gave you that is like, was the snake that's really ornamental. And I was like, oh my gosh, I think I may have had one of those too.
You probably did. I am confident that like every single person who socialized in the 80s and 90s had this belt. My mom loved it. It was this, it's this, and it had this like kind of clever catch where like it was actually Ouroboros. It like the, you know, the mouth of the snake and the tail of the snake like clicked together. And it was very, very, you know, sort of sneaky and it jingled and it jangled and it had this sort of like very flowy and snake snake like feel to it. And it was actually that belt that kind of worked the metaphor for me in that story, is this idea of snakes and like tongues and teeth and bites and scales and this very hard, soft feeling. Snakes are frequently misunderstood. It is only as having been a parent who is suddenly watching wilderness shows that I know way more about snakes than I ever needed to know.
Okay.
But realizing that like they are really misunderstood, and that they are fantastic, you know, parents, and that they are beautiful and sleek and smooth, and snakes don't give a shit what you think about what they look like. They don't. They're there to, you know, defend themselves or to take you out or whatever needs to be done. And so that belt that my mom gave me, because she was like, oh, I guess I don't need this. It doesn't fit. And she was so sad. But, you know, like it, I was like, oh, I love this belt. This is very cool. And I wore it out to nightclubs and thought I was the coolest thing that there was. And
absolutely.
If I found one of those at a thrift shop today, I'd buy it 100% and I would wear it, and I would wear it well.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it is definitely a deciding factor. And who knew that belts were so important to like what you consider to be like a put together outfit?
Totally.
Never mind the function of holding your pants up.
Totally.
But like, is a belt really that important? And if you don't wear it, are you less of a person?
For me, it's a really limiting thing to wear a belt because of the shape of my body, because of the way things, where everything pokes and sits down. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of what you were talking about with your experiences too, with sitting down in it. It kind of slides up and your pants slide down, and it's just, it's so uncomfortable. And it's like, why are we putting ourselves through this?
Yeah. Why are we doing this? Why are we trying to make ourselves like this extra layer where it's like hot and uncomfortable and it pinches you and it's not even holding your pants up?
No.
Like, you know, I started realizing that, I mean, going back, I was never the type of young woman who felt obliged to wear makeup, who, you know, did my hair. I don't begrudge any person who chooses to do those things because it makes them feel good about themselves. And I think that's awesome that you have found things that make you feel good about yourself. And for me, it was never about that. And clothing, I realized pretty quickly, also wasn't about that. I mean, after I had my son, I had gained baby weight, and I'm totally air quoting that. But after I had my son, I was way bigger and a way different shape, and my body had moved differently, and like things just sort of slid down my frame and sort of settled in my stomach area. And, you know, those first 3 or 4 months postpartum are really, really tough, and you're expected to just like magically bounce back. Like suddenly it's you're going to be exactly at your pre-pregnancy weight. Well, what if your pre-pregnancy weight wasn't something that was also socially acceptable? Were you expected to lose even more weight and be in your pre-pre-pre-pregnancy weight? And so I really struggled with that. And it was when my son, like, and I described this in my piece, he like touched my belly and was like, oh, I love your squishy belly, and like put his head on my tummy and was like, it was a pillow and it was a place of comfort and love and of feeling cared for him. So it was like, why don't I care about myself the same way he cares about me? Like this is transformative. And this is important for me to recognize that the way that I had carried myself and sort of held myself to a standard that I actually didn't even believe in the first place, it all came undone when I became a parent. And I hate to like hang all of my self-worth on being a parent, because I actually think that that is a tricky, slippery slope. You know, I think that a lot of women, whenever I hear of terms like mompreneur, or when I hear of other women whose entire self-worth has been built around their identity as a parent, I struggle a little bit with that, because I'm so much more than a parent. I'm an interesting person. I write great stuff. I'm super creative. I'm pretty funny, I think. You know, so like, I really struggled with like, is this the catalyst? Was this the thing that has changed my entire perspective of myself? And I guess, yeah, it was. But what it did is it actually just let me think about the fact that I hadn't been kind to myself for a long time. And I still struggle with being kind to myself. I still struggle with the idea of who I am and what I should look like and what my shape should be. And there's a lot of shoulds. And I guess that that's the part that I'm trying to like break apart in myself and realize that it's unimportant and that it only matters to me. And so I need to continue to do the work. And I think we constantly have to do the work of recognizing and being kind to ourselves that it's okay to love the person we are in the shape we are in, or to choose to change it because we want to and not for any standard that we're being held to.
Right. Oh, isn't that the truth? Yes. And you touched on so many things that were in your piece that, I mean, we could go into aging because you talk about aging, you talk about body shame. You talk about the support you got that you found in the dojo, in the karate dojo. And I think that there's some real relevant points to pick out there in terms of, you know, the body liberation community. But what I want to ask you about is your son, because you've talked quite a bit about that experience of having a son and how that has changed you. And I've gotten a lot of questions that I don't quite know how to answer because I don't have kids, about raising a child not to have body shame and to be okay with the diversity of bodies that we have in this world. So do you have any tips around doing that, or what your experience has been like trying to do that?
Yeah. So I think every parent and every child will have to navigate their own sort of personal journey on that. But I will say that there's been a few things that have been really helpful for me. And one is the recognition that it is more important to teach boys and kids who identify as boys, it is more important to teach them to understand body issues than it is girls, because women and girls and those who identify that way, we have been raised to understand that there are body issues and that we have to question ourselves. That has been bred into us, that has been pounded into us, right, starting from kindergarten. But boys tend to float through that conversation, and it is not until girls start to develop and start to have breasts or hips, or start to experiment with makeup and fun hair in a way that boys don't quite understand and have not previously had exposure. So talking about your body in a neutral way, even if you don't love your body, I think just agreeing to speak about yourself in a neutral way right from a very early age for boys is critically important that they understand. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important, just like it's important with kids, to sort of acknowledge that sometimes you have crappy feelings and sometimes you're sad and sometimes you're angry. And like, those are real feelings and they have importance, and you can name them, and that they're really, really valid. And so just like that, it's important for boys especially to learn that some women don't feel super great about their body. And so, you know, we've all heard jokes and we've all laughed about like a little boy who like walked up to a woman and is like, "Why is your tummy so fat?" and sort of made these sort of like innocent but harmful comments, because it's loaded conversation, it's loaded language that they use a lot of times, and it's impossible to avoid. So my son now is in grade 7, and grade 7 is like the middle of middle school. It's like literally the shittiest time of a child's life. You couldn't ask for a shittier time. And it is the time at which the difference between those who present as girls and those who present as boys seem to be the largest divide. Mm. And acknowledging that it is okay to question whether or not you like yourself, and it is okay to reject what other people think, and that it is okay to verbalize, and that it is okay to call out when someone is fat phobic or make shameful remarks that are related to a person's shape. And giving them the language to say, actually, it's not okay that you said that. You know, my friend can't help what they look like right now. Or it's not okay that you said that. My friend doesn't need you to say those kinds of words. And to kind of understand where shame fits into it. Shame is a really complicated emotion to learn. And it's hard to put your finger on what's shame. I mean, as adults, we probably can be like, oh, I felt very ashamed at that moment my life, or that was very shameful and I feel terrible. But as children, you know, we learn happy and we learn mad and we learn sad and we learn these very sort of like obvious and sort of typical emotions, but we don't learn the really nuanced language related to emotions like shame, which is difficult and wrapped up in so many things. And so I think maybe sometimes a bit outside the age range of what my son knows, I've discussed feelings. So, you know, I put on a swimsuit at one point when we went camping when he was little, and I put a towel around my waist. I don't know why I did, but I put a towel around my waist and I tied it up like it was like a skirt, like it was magically going to hide right. my large stomach, right? And we walked down to the lake and he's like, why do you have a towel around your waist? Like, that feels like a totally unnecessary thing. Obviously, he used much more childlike language, but he was like, Mom, why are you wearing a towel? And I was like, I don't know why I'm wearing a towel. I guess I felt like I should wear a towel. And he's like, why? Why did you feel like you should have a towel around your waist? I'm like, I'm not sure. I really appreciate you kind of pointing it out because it's given me food for thought. And I think that kind of acknowledging that kids' perspectives is also valuable for you as an adult to figure out who you are is important. And then secondarily, that was a lot of primarily, but secondarily, I really think it's important that we acknowledge that everyone's place in this world is a little bit different. And so, you know, like you were saying about plus size clothing, and like I personally have the privilege to be able to just go buy new clothes if my size 16 pants aren't fitting quite great or my size 20 pants aren't fitting quite great. I have the privilege to go and buy a few new clothes. And so when my son and I kind of navigate things like clothing drives, for example, we purposely buy larger sizes that are outside of things, or we purposely buy things that are harder to come by so that he can acknowledge that it is more difficult for people. It's no different than purchasing especially nutritious gluten-free food for the food bank, because you know it's not something that the food bank often has. It's the same thing. It's making an accommodation for someone without making it about shame. So I think that just involving them in those conversations is critically important, and examining your own relationship with some of those feelings that you're actually attempting to educate them about makes a big difference. Letting them see you cry, letting them see you be sad, letting them see you experience some of those feelings, and reflecting on what that means and how you could have done something different, I think goes a long way for kids.
I love all of that. And it wasn't too much primarily at all. That was wonderful. Okay, wonderful. That was so great. We could probably go on about this for a really long time, but I really do want to respect your time. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on Fat Girl Book Club.
Thanks so much for having me. I absolutely enjoyed myself in this. I feel very honored actually to be invited on something like this. And I feel like it's wonderful to share. One of the great things of the pandemic is that we have opportunities like this that maybe we wouldn't have explored pre-pandemic times.
That's the truth. It's good. Ugh, that's so, so true. Wasn't that a great conversation? One of the things that's definitely going to keep percolating in my mind from that conversation was Jen's discussion around boys and body image. I mean, girls really do get shoved into body image stuff. We can't get away from it. But boys, it's a little different with the way we socialize boys, with the way we get them to think about their bodies. And it's not that boys don't have body image stuff going on, but it is harder for them to vocalize what is actually happening. And so that discussion with Jen is going to keep percolating in my mind. That is definitely interesting to me. Okay, the next discussion that I had was with Dr. Rohini Banerjee. And this was also a really interesting conversation. Let me give you Rohini's bio. Dr. Rohini Banerjee was born and raised in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, Canada, the daughter of immigrants from Himachal Pradesh, India. She is an associate professor of French and Francophone Studies in the Department of Modern Languages and Classics, graduate coordinator of the International Development Studies Program, and a faculty member in the Asian Studies and Graduate Women and Gender Studies Program at St. Mary's University, Halifax, Canada. Rohini's primary research focuses on the literatures and cultures of the Francophone Indian Ocean. When she is not teaching poetry and fiction, she attempts to write it herself. Her work has appeared with Cambridge Scholars, Caitlin Press and Canadian Scholars, and Women's Press. When not teaching or writing, Rohini serves as president of the St. Mary's University Faculty Union and as a vice chair of Academic Senate. Rohini self-identifies as a woman scholar of color. Please enjoy this mini conversation with Dr. Rohini Banerjee. Hi, Rohini. Welcome to Fat Girl Book Club.
Hi, Jen.
We're here to talk about your story that was done for this really great anthology. Mm-hmm. It's big, Stories About Life in Plus Size Bodies. Can you talk a little bit about what your relationship was like with your body before writing the story?
What a great question. So it was really we talk about writing as a way of processing our life. You know, we talk about, those of us who know The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron know about the morning pages and getting everything out on paper, filling in your three pages in the morning, not thinking, prescribing to a certain methodology, but just letting pen hit paper. And before, when I saw the call, I struggled with what I think some debutant authors might feel often, who are feeling a little bit vulnerable about the idea of their work actually being published and read. So we fantasize about getting on a podcast with someone like yourself, or Sheila Rogers reading your story. Yeah. Like how amazing of a moment would that be? But then when it actually happens, there's a sense of vulnerability. And I feel like at that time in my life, I was living in Eastern Ontario, very much missing the Maritimes. I was on sabbatical from a university. Mm-hmm. I was very much in a slight quarantine lifestyle because I was driving kids to school and then sitting in yoga pants in front of my monitor, trying to produce scholarship, because I'm a university professor and that's what you're supposed to do during your sabbatical. But really lonely and missing campus and missing the socialization. And yes. I wasn't really huge on social media, but I had, delved into it. And I noticed more and more and more my body was really unhappy, unhappy. And I say my body was unhappy, and I felt a lethargy, a sadness, a mm-hmm. chagrin. I don't know how else to really, but it was packed into the body. And I really thought perhaps this was a moment for me to really talk about that sadness that I was holding in mm-hmm. in my body. And I call it, in the story, I really kind of unpack it slowly. But it came to me knowing that I needed to release whatever was holding me back. And I was probably the heaviest I had been, knowing my family history, and then getting worried about that and worried that I'm going to, be diagnosed with X, Y, and Z. I'm in my 40s. It's all going to happen to me like it happened to my parents. And so this constant sense of dread and really hating the body. And I felt like I needed to give my body some space and some time to like unwind and release some of that sadness. So it was really not about my heart or my soul or my mind, but it was really about my body, which I really have not loved in a long time. Mm-hmm. And I think this was a way for me to start loving my body again.
So what was the process like to actually get this out on paper? So your story is called Barbra Streisand or Bust. So can you talk a little bit about what was in the story and then what the process was like of writing that all out?
I've always been a performer in my fantasy world of myself. So I'm a Gemini. I believe in that sort of, I have a persona that I present to the world. And then I have this like secret in the shower persona, right? This person that I have inside. And, we talk about performers often, at least musical performers, who have a persona and then a real self. But I really felt that a lot of people didn't know that I actually wanted to be an opera singer since I was a kid. I've always wanted to be, and I thought these incredible women who are full size with amazing makeup and costumes and the set and the symphony and the story and the multiple languages. I teach in French. So like this capacity to speak such languages yeah. in an art form was like mesmerizing to me. But I was secretly a super quiet, shy kid. So I was like, I did not speak, yeah. which is my students find that completely hard to believe because that's what I do for my life and my job, right? Is lecture. My kids don't believe me, but I was really, really quiet. And I talk about that in the book, in the story. Sorry. I talk about mm-hmm. that in the story. Mm-hmm. I actually say like, you know, I was muted by, you know, the pain of carrying the body that I had, not loving it and not understanding how to love the shape that I had, seeing my body transform beyond just puberty, but noticing that everything was getting fuller and tighter and, in different ways than my other friends. And then being a person of color and knowing that I not knowing at the time, but understanding it now that I had internalized racism. And then I'm decolonizing myself right now in my own standards of beauty and seeing more and more how a sari fits on my body and makes me a sensual sexual being and understanding that the curves, of 9 meters of material on any shape body is absolutely beautiful. And not really understanding how a sari could be so empowering because I just saw myself as somebody who didn't fit into the blouses, who didn't, you know, whose shoulders were really broad. You know, when I would go to a tailor, the tailor would say, oh, we're going to have to put some extra material in because of your shoulders. And forgetting that really it's the sari and the nine meters of material that's going to wrap around my body, no matter how big or small I was. The process of writing was going back to that place when I was a kid and like loving Barbra Streisand. And I loved her in the 70s. I loved the Neil Diamond, Barbra Streisand, You Don't Bring Me Flowers Anymore. It was like, and my dad was Neil Diamond and I was Barbra Streisand. And, you know, family would come over and they'd be like, do you want to sing your song? And I would take my mom's, you know, hairbrush and sing. And I, you know, I wasn't expected to be perfect. It was actually a really happy time for me. I have beautiful memories of me in the family living room, singing the song to my dad, who was of course, Neil Diamond. And my mom was a florist as well as a nurse. And so she would do flower arrangements and she did it as a side gig. And so I remember having a great relationship with flowers. And then this idea of, you know, someone not bringing flowers anymore to anybody, such so sad. So I had a connection with the song. And I think deep down inside, I was always somebody who was creative with words. So the process of bringing Barbra Streisand in is interesting because she's somebody who actually had a lot of stage fright and also wasn't always happy with the way that she presented, which, you know, we would say, my gosh, Barbra Streisand is Barbra Streisand. Like she's one of the greatest singers, but you know, she struggled, right? She struggled with her own image, her own facial features, the range of her voice. And she had great stage fright. And we hear about this from other singers. And so I think her as somebody who I wanted to be and this operatic life that I secretly wanted for me was a figure of strength for me and really was the center of what I wanted to talk about in the story.
Yes. Yes. Because one of the themes that keeps coming up in your story is finding your voice and at the beginning, not really finding your voice. And like you said, being muted and then by the end being able to vocalize. So that's an interesting timeline that goes through there. Was there any moments in your life that really changed things for you? Because I know you talk about your uncle kind of having this feeling that you shouldn't be as quiet as you are, you shouldn't be shy, and that you're kind of attaching your shyness to your body size. And then you talk about how you found your voice. What was the catalyst in between there?
Such a good question. I feel like, you know, when my uncle was sort of prodding my family, my parents, you know, his sister, my mom, like, what's wrong with your kid? Like, we know she's smart. You know, we know she's a debater. She does debating society, but she can't have a conversation with me without, you know, shutting down. And it's because I didn't want people to look at me, right? I wanted to have the camera off if that's possible. And, you know, I remember struggling with just walking down the road because I was worried people were just looking at my face, at my body, at my full cheeks, at my round nose, my dark skin. I just hated everything about me. And so I think it really helped when I went to France when I was 19, kind of ran away, you know, convinced my dad that I needed some credits for my degree. So I was doing a biology and French degree, which of course makes total sense. And you know, my father was like, okay, what are you going to do? Don't go to Paris and become a go-go dancer, like come back. And I think I really got the attention of men, and I had not really had that. I didn't know how to be around men. And it's interesting because we often try to find, we want to, as, you know, autonomous, intelligent, professional women, we want to have validation from the inner self. But we are human beings, and we do look for validation outside of the self. And, you know, it takes a long time. I'll be turning 45 at the end of a month. You know, I'm still working on, you know, self-care, self-validation. But when you're 19 and you've not liked your body and you don't like yourself, you do look for it from outside, yes, outside of the self. And so it was my sort of a first experience with European men, and not understanding the naivete of the situation, not really understanding some of the subtle racism that I was experiencing, not understanding all of that, because I was sort of in this cloud-like state all the time. Mm-hmm. And when I returned, that very sexual self of mine had finally come out. I was always thought of erotica, loved the sensual side of writing. I've always thought about sex and enjoyed the idea of it, but really never explored my body or my own needs. Really, I had not had a partner. And so when I returned to Canada, I started being more aggressive with what I wanted, and not necessarily with men or with desire, but really, but everything. So, you know, I told my parents, like, I really want to do a master's in French. I applied to medical school and didn't get in, and they were delighted for me, telling me that I could break away from the stereotype of the South Asian doctor. You don't have to be that person. You can do what you want. That's why we came to this country. And so that was freeing. And I think in that freedom, I started to feel that I could talk about what I wanted, and, you know, I landed the first real boyfriend and started enjoying my body a bit more. Still trepidous about parts of me, you know, and looking back at my wedding photo and thinking, gosh darn it, I was pretty cute. But did I have that in my brain at the time that I was? No, not at all. And so it's fascinating to see that trajectory and that pathway of opening up and hearing one's voice. I understand now the power that I have as somebody who is a public person, in the sense that I engage with young people. You know, I'm very proud to have students who look like me, and I hope that I can show them and tell them, like, guess what? Like, your professor, who you think is this glorious person, really struggled as a teenager, really struggled as a 10-year-old, and is still struggling in her 40s. I think that helps young people to see that, you know, it is an ongoing process of loving oneself, of loving the body, you know, and particularly when you have children and your body changes, and then owning that and enjoying that process.
So what, and that is all amazing. And what I'd really like to dive into, I know I don't have a lot of time here with you, but I'd really like to dive into your parents, because it was such a beautiful part of the story, talking about them and what you're saying now. There seemed to be this link, a link between immigration and size of bodies.
Yes. Fascinating. Yes. Thank you for the question. Thank you for asking that question. I'm fascinated with the brown body. I'm fascinated with the body that is not white, because I craved and wanted to be white looking, white acting, white speaking, white believing, thinking, and learning now more and more that, you know, truly I have been gifted with the combination of DNA that I have. My mom, I remember, you know, very young, talking about skincare and skin rituals, and a lot of it is passed down, you know, matrilineally, mm-hmm. with the sense that, you know, moms and grandmothers have concoctions at home to talk about caring for one's skin. There's a whole ritual that happens when you get married, at least in Punjabi culture, where turmeric and oatmeal and nuts are rubbed into almost like a toothpaste type of thing, and it's rubbed all over your body to prepare the woman for her conjugal evening that she'll be having, but also to give her advice and to have the aunties around to let her know what it's going to be like, et cetera, et cetera. And it's really a bonding of women and women's bodies and sexuality, and really actually opening out and talking about it. And my mother was very liberated, if you want to say that, from the beginning. She was 21 years old, moved to Prince Edward Island, unmarried in 1968. That was a very big rebellious move for her. Yes. But her dad was really supportive and wanted her to get out before she married the kid from down the road. And she was a nurse and made her own money and, you know, did her own thing and didn't marry until mid-70s. So that was I have that as a role model, and I'm grateful that, you know, I can drive in 10 minutes and see her whenever I want. And she has always been someone who reminded me that, you know, we are beautiful spirits. Now, she also saw how I struggled with my friends who were, you know, white and who I wanted to emulate. And she herself is darker skinned than me. And we have colorism, shadism in, you know, in peoples of color. And that's a whole other, episode for you to explore. Where one who is darker skinned is considered, you know, someone of a lower class, works outside as a laborer. And those who are lighter skinned are considered of a higher class or a higher status of some sort. And so she herself struggled with her dark copper skin, married to my dad, who was very fair skinned and light skinned. And then I was a sort of medium person, and she would try to protect me, you know, and say to me, well before SPF ever, you know, happened, was covering me up with hats or umbrellas. And I didn't really know, but any kid who's brown knows what that means. And that was, protect yourself from, you know, from getting too dark. And I think that deep down inside, the messaging that she was trying to tell me was, I'm protecting you from society, but you're still beautiful. And so I think that what I really want to honor my parents, because when they saw me changing my persona, my voice, as I became a university professor and started wearing professor clothes, or, you know, being able to buy nice shoes or put on a proper blazer, the first thing that she would say is, you look great. You look beautiful. Keep dressing for the job that you want. And always would be encouraging me to be myself. Yeah. And there were times when, you know, post babies, things wouldn't fit. I felt uncomfortable. You know, I was struggling with how I was dealing with my own feelings and using food in unhealthy ways. She would say, this too shall pass. So I've always had great support. They both wanted me to pursue what I wanted and never tried to put me in a box. I think they knew that their kid was an opera singer. She was somebody who was not going to follow that lane that was assumed to be what a kid of Indian immigrants is supposed to be. They know some of the struggles of managing, you know, white dominant culture. And now, you know, I'll tease her and I'll say, you know, I'm putting on extra bronzer because I want to darken up right now. I'm feeling a little yellow. And she'll joke and she'll say, you know, you're lucky now that you know that you're lucky that you're able to get that color whenever you want. I didn't know that back then. So she herself is decolonizing herself after 50 plus years in Canada. You know, these are colonial thoughts. These are ways of thinking that we don't really even realize we withhold. And when I talk about sadness in the body, part of that sadness of the body is the decolonizing, right? So when you talk about opening up your voice, for me, it's about decolonizing myself. When you ask me how to pronounce my name, that's part of the decolonization process. For me, it's about saying, thank you, Jennifer, you know, asking me how to pronounce my name. And in the glory of, as I remove all that sadness from my body, I am voicing, you know, my love for my body. And that includes the fact that parts of my body are lighter skin than the other, that, you know, I've got patchy elbows or patchy knees, that I've got scars here and there that will never heal properly and will always leave back a black mark. And the power of concealer. So, you know, I think that all of that is a reminder. I've been reminded by my parents that brown skin is beautiful.
That's lovely. That is lovely. Well, today, right now, as we sit here, what is your relationship like with your body now?
That's a good question. You know, right now at this moment, I'm loving the fact that I can have access to healthy fitness, so online. So I'm online doing online classes. And yesterday was Mother's Day, And, you know, I thought I would give myself a break. So I said, oh, I'm going to take a rest. So I slept in a little bit. I pushed back on my morning routine. And by 3 o'clock, I was craving some exercise. And so that was telling me that your body wants love. Your body wants to move. Your body needs to move. So my thinking has really shifted, and I have been exercising regularly, I think most of the month of April. So I can't say that I'm a regular exerciser, but now I can. Actually, now I can say that I actually exercise every day. Now, this is not somebody who did that all the time. I actually enjoy going to the gym if we could. I actually enjoy going and putting on the headphones and getting a little outfit and doing something on the treadmill. But I now see, because I can feel it in my body, that it wants love.
Yes.
And that was very empowering. And that was yesterday afternoon. And I went, wait a second, something doesn't feel right here. And I stripped down into spandex, and the chicken and the potatoes were in the oven. I'm like, how much time do I have? I got 25 minutes. I'm going to jam this in.
Yes.
And it wasn't torture. It wasn't hate. It wasn't, look at you, you terrible person. Look at you, you lazy person. Yeah. Look at you, you unhealthy person. It was, your body needs love. So that is my relationship. I try to move her every day in different ways. I put on body cream in the morning and body cream at night to remind me of all my crevices and all my spots. It's actually a very self-soothing, self-loving act, I find. I remember my mother always telling me, you know, put some body cream before you go to bed, and I would never listen to her. And now I do. I go through tubs of cream, and I feel silky and sort of ready for bed and ready for that relaxation. Yeah. And that has been touching my body more, stretching my body more, pushing my body to points of difficult places, but not out of torture or hate.
Yeah. The fact that you're able to connect with what your body is needing and honoring that is such a beautiful thing. Like, that's amazing. And something we get told over and over again, we're not supposed to do. So it's lovely that you're able to do that and honor that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, people, I was asked recently, what is my version of self-care? And I'm like, I am not a bubble bath person. I mean, that for me is a very white woman thing to do. My mother would be like, what are you doing in the bath? Putting in bubbles to make you have water. Like, she would think that was so strange. Dirty. After like 10 minutes, you're dirty, right? And so it's so funny when I think about self-care now. It's actually getting up before all the kids do, having coffee, doing a meditation ritual, like just something like 10 minutes, just, you know, something self-affirming. Maybe a bit of social media, but nothing major. Morning pages, maybe like three pages from a book if I can squeeze it in, and exercise. And I literally laugh at myself because I think, really? Like, exercise is that's what you really want to do? Yes, I really want to do exercise. And, you know, I've had a hip replacement a few years back, and I was 31 when I had it. And, you know, I know that I'm coming up to the 20-year mark soon where it will have to be replaced. And I'm always sort of waiting for that day where I hear something or feel something and I'm going to have to go into the hospital. And I want to be ready for that marathon that will be that surgery at my age at that time, which will be hopefully when I'm after 50. But I will not be the same person that I was when I was 31. So I'm aware that there's a little bit of a sense of dread, but I try to live in the moment. And yeah, self-care for me is not about that. It's also just even, you know, after this podcast time with you, perhaps turning the screen down and sitting somewhere quiet for just 5 minutes and thinking about what just happened. So like, what did I tell Jen? What meaning does that have for me? You know, how will this impact the listeners? I mean, just even having that digestive time instead of getting onto the next call or getting onto the next thing. That's also self-care for me, but not fluffy bubble baths. I do like bubble baths, but I'm always worried I'm going to drop my book in the water. So,
yes,
and I get cold really quickly. So
exactly. Yeah. No, I'd take a warm shower over a bubble bath any day. So I hear you on that one. Well, I have taken up enough of your time. I just want to thank you very much, Rohini, for being on Fat Girl Book Club.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I can't wait to hear it all.
I think that discussion with Rohini was so important and really fascinating. I'm a white woman, lived here my entire life, never experiencing the things that she has experienced. And I love that she was so vulnerable about sharing that with us. Her experiences, talking about her own decolonization. Now that is what I'm going to take away from this conversation, because I will never truly understand that process, but on a intellectual level, I can understand how difficult that would be. And I empathize with that struggle. I love that conversation so much. That's going to be a tough one to get out of my mind. My next conversation was with Sally Kwan, and I'm going to read you her bio. Sally Kwan is a writer and photographer, rediscovering her voice after a long confinement. She has been published in numerous anthologies, including Voicing Suicide by Ecstatic Editions and I Don't Cry Anymore by Liminal Press. Sally is an associate member of the League of Canadian Poets. Her personal blog, which will be in the show notes, featherstone-creative.com, is where she posts her backcountry adventures, photos, and stories. Please enjoy this mini conversation with Sally Kwan.
Hi, Sally. Welcome to Fat Girl Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled that you're here. I'm just thrilled. So we're going to be talking about your story in this anthology, Big Stories About Life in Plus Size Bodies. I absolutely loved this collection. This was an amazing thing to be a part of. So to start off, can you tell the listeners a little bit about how you got involved with the project, how you found out about it?
It was something that I just came across on Facebook. I'm not even sure how it happened. But when I saw what the subject was, I thought, oh, I could talk about that. And then I put it off and I put it off and I put it off. And then one night I just sat down and started to write. And honestly, the whole experience was I just wrote and wrote and wrote. And afterwards, I almost didn't send it in because it was so angry. But the fact that I had written it at all was such a cathartic feeling. And I thought, well, you know what? What the hell? Let's just go with it. And I sent it in. I was quite surprised when it was chosen because, like I say, it wasn't really a positive story at all. But I'm sure it's relatable for a lot of people.
Oh boy. Yes. Yes. It's absolutely relatable. Do you want to talk a little bit about what your story is, what happens in your story, and especially how you ended it? Because I loved it.
Well, basically it's about all of the things that you just don't think about if you're living in a slender world, like how difficult it is to get out of a parked vehicle when the lines are too close together, how changing rooms in any department store or clothing store are almost always too small, which makes shopping at all, which is already an uncomfortable, terrible thing, because nothing ever looks right. And then suddenly you're struggling and sweating and squirming and trying to get into clothes. It just makes the whole experience an absolute nightmare. So my piece was really about the things that people don't really think about. One of my personal ones is being led to a booth in a restaurant that where the table doesn't move and you don't fit. And it would be really nice if the rest of the world could anticipate that and not put you through having to say, do you have a different table? You know, I'm not going to fit in this one, but they don't. And I guess that's just something that we have to deal with. And my particular pet peeve, the one that you're talking about that I ended the story on, is men who say the exact phrase is, oh, I can't, I have to watch my girlish figure. And it just pisses me off. So,
I mean, so many different things, but the objectification of women, the idea that women need to be a certain figure, This idea that the food we choose actually has some sort of bearing on our morality. I just love the way you ended that, because it just got me thinking about all those different things.
Well, I'm glad that it gave you pause for thought. I mean, like I said, just the fact that I wrote it made me feel better, like I was finally letting go of something that had been building inside of me, because, you know, it's not really something that I faced up to, you know, the fact that I had become a large person or a plus size person. And so all of those little things just kept kind of building up until they finally exploded.
Yeah. So when you talk about this being a cathartic experience, can you talk a little bit about how you felt about your body before writing and then after writing? Was there a big difference in how you even viewed yourself?
Not a huge difference, but, you know, I mean, I was not happy with my body before I wrote it, and I'm not happy with my body now. Less about how I look and more about the health issues that come along with being, you know, the medical term is actually morbidly obese, which I think is a terrible, terrible name. It should be something, you know, less creepy.
Yep. No, I completely agree.
But the big change is that once I wrote it, I was more willing to accept it. So I guess, you know, I may still not be happy about it,
right?
But at least I accept that that's what it is. So I can go to a restaurant, and when the hostess leads me to a booth that I don't fit in, I don't feel anger when I say I need a different spot. You know, so that much at least has changed. I don't randomly take it out on people who just really don't have a clue.
Yes. I love that. That's a pretty big shift. I mean,
well, for myself. Yeah. And I mean, last summer, my son and I went on a vacation, and we booked a whitewater rafting trip, which, you know, was bizarre that I'd even consider doing that. But, you know, I told the girl as I was booking it over the phone, I said, I'm, you know, really overweight. I've got limited mobility. And she's like, oh, yeah, no problem. It's not going to be an issue for you. But it was actually. The issue was getting from the place where we checked in to the river. And I, you know, I can't really blame her. She's 20 something, absolutely skinny as a rail, and has no idea, you know. But so it was a real struggle for me. But I'm so glad that I went, because it was really a joyful experience. It was just the getting there that was difficult. But like I say, you know, I find that I'm more willing to accept the fact that people are not necessarily conscious of what they're doing. They're not doing it to be mean, right? There's a difference in that. So, you know, if you can tell the difference between those two kinds of people, it makes your own life easier.
And how do you have any thoughts around how we can start to get some of these people to think about these issues? People that, like you say, there are two types of people: the people who actually it would make a difference to their levels of empathy if we did give them the information.
You know, the only thing that that you can do is just tell them, but be polite. You know, I try not to snap. And then so that maybe the next person that comes along that is plus size, they'll go, oh yeah, you know, we need a table that isn't cemented to the ground, right?
Right, right.
That's really all we can do, is to sort of spread awareness ourselves.
Yeah, I agree. And I love that you're saying that you've kind of let go of the anger. I mean, I think anger is a really powerful emotion, but it can be so harmful to ourselves, like to us, that if we let it fester, then it's just going to cause more problems than it's worth. So I love that you said that you're able to do that. So do you have one tip for someone who is in a plus size body of how they can start to move towards accepting their body? Like, you talked about how maybe you didn't even realize that writing out your story would make such a big difference. So that's one thing. Do you have anything else that do you think maybe people could do to move themselves towards more of a body acceptance mindset?
Honestly, I don't. It's something that I'm still working very hard on. Like I said, you know, and I journal a lot. So when I am feeling, you know, all of those things that come along with being in a plus size body, I still write it out. So that would be, you know, my number one go-to. And yeah, I, like I say, I'm still working on it myself. I'm still not a happy person. So yeah, the myth that all overweight people are happy and jolly, that's got to go.
Well, you're allowed to be. We all don't have to be the same. And I actually, I kind of love that you said that too. I mean, the fact that you know yourself like that, how many people can say that I know myself enough that I'm not going to turn into a happy person?
But actually, the funny thing is, it's that it's only about my body that I'm like that. In the rest of my life, for the most part, I am happy. You know, it's just whenever I'm faced with the issues that come from being plus size that I get angry or unhappy. So, you know, that's something that's just going to require continual work.
Right. Well, and like your story said, it's not like you can easily get away from those things. Like it really impacts a lot of different aspects of your life. Like you talked about not wanting to go to the beach during the regular time. You have to get up early to go. And you talked about even some of the clients where you work not wanting to work with you because of your size. Like those are things you can't escape from. So,
but that's actually something that since writing that piece that has changed. I'll go to the beach whenever I damn well want to.
You know, oh, yay.
So yeah, that's something I'm not going to let that restrict me. I just don't give a shit. If I'm hot and I want to hit the water, I'm going. So.
That's amazing. That's wonderful. That is so cool. Well, you know, I loved what you wrote. I loved, and I know you talk about the anger in here. I love the anger. I do think that it felt like a cathartic piece. I love that you bring these issues up for people who maybe don't have the same issues, who didn't know and didn't realize. I think that that's wonderful. And I thank you very much for actually submitting this piece when you didn't think that you were going to.
Well, thank you very much for all those nice things that you said.
Thank you so much for being on Fat Girl Book Club.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, boy. I tell you, that discussion, when we started talking about some of those little experiences that as a person in a plus size body, we have to deal with, that, you know, I mean, being in a plus size body and dealing with those things means we, to some degree, don't even really think about the fact that it's because we are in a plus size body that we're having to deal with it. Like when I go to a store and the clothes don't fit, I am not thinking about the fact that it's the clothing store that is the problem. I'm thinking I'm the problem. And it's the same thing when we go into a restaurant and the booths don't fit. We think that that's our fault as opposed to being the restaurant's fault. And I think that those little experiences as they accumulate is what creates this kind of fat anger that we have, this, or at least that I know I've experienced, this anger, not just at myself for being in a plus size body, but for the world to not accommodate my body. I get so upset because it's not, I shouldn't have to deal with all these little small T traumas every day just because of the size of my body. And while being accepting of my body is great, I can be as accepting as I want of my body till I'm blue in the face. It's not going to solve the issue that is having to deal with these little experiences every day. So I felt like this is, again, that is what I am going to be taking away from that conversation, was this sense of anger that we have to deal with this and why we shouldn't have to deal with this. The last conversation that I had was with Caroline Minnie. Let me read you Caroline's bio. Caroline Minnie is a prairie nomad living in Metro Vancouver. She's been obsessed with online culture since the mid-1990s when she first surfed the web as a staff music writer for everythingcool.com. Over the past 20 years, her poetry, arts reviews, and travel features have been published online and in print. Please enjoy this conversation with Caroline Minnie.
Hi, Caroline. Welcome to Fat Girl Book Club.
Hi, Jen. Thank you for having me.
I am excited to dive into your story that you wrote for this really great anthology, but let's start with a little bit about what your relationship was like to your body before you wrote the story, and maybe a little bit about how you found out about this project.
Mm-hmm. That's a really great question. Really great couple of questions, actually. And I would have to say, when I was writing this story, I felt great about my body. I felt like I was very comfortable with so much of my body. I had discovered health. I had discovered strength. I had rediscovered sexuality and a chronic health condition that had been really problematic for a long time seemed to have gone into remission. Mm-hmm. And I had this delusional self-belief that it was because of actions I had taken. So I felt all powerful. I felt big and I felt fat and I felt seen and wonderful, absolutely wonderful at that point of writing. And I think that's why I was so open to contributing to the project.
Yes, yes. And how did you hear about the project?
I heard about it through a listserv. A friend of a friend tipped me onto a listserv and then lo and behold, there was the perfect call for submissions at this time. And I thought, I'm going to give it a go. I have no clue what's going to happen, but I think it'll be cathartic to do some, you know, memoir work to put it out there, to do that reflection. And I think with my story, because I'm looking back at how I felt about my body in relation to dating when I was first doing online dating in the late 90s, and then reflecting on my relationship with my body in relation to online dating in my late 30s, it was easy to compare and contrast, right? And the self-confidence that usually builds over time, by the time you're in your late 30s, can smooth out a lot of the discomfort often. Mm-hmm. At least it did for me. And so it made it a pretty affirming experience.
Okay, so the process, I think you kind of answered this. So the process of writing about your body really just made you feel more powerful. It really sounded like it was a really empowering experience for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an empowering experience for me. I think the difficulty of having to describe my body, write about my body, think about my body, when I was in my teens and I felt like such an outlier and I felt so visible in ways I never wanted to be visible. It was really difficult and it was fraught with a lot of risk. Mm-hmm. And when I was taking on that sort of work again in my 30s, having recently become single and decided to date, there was risk. There's always risk of rejection, right? And that's uncomfortable and it's scary. But there was a lot more comfort too in being able to show what I look like and not have to rely on words in the same way to do the work, right? Mm-hmm. And sort of grasp at acceptability, sort of like, here I am, this is what I look like. You can swipe on me or you cannot. And if you don't, I'll never hear about it. I'll never have a date show up and then walk out. I'll never have a boy make a fat joke at me and like friend zone me when I and blindside me by it, right? I would have people who show up at a date, coffee date or drinks after work, because I had passed their filter of attractiveness and vice versa. So there's a lot more safety in it now, right? Yeah. Don't have to rely on words in the same way.
Oh, that is so interesting. Oh, that is so interesting. And I really, really want to talk to you more about online dating and online dating while fat and all the rest of it. But let's start with you explaining a little bit about your story. So the story is called B Words and F Words, Safety, Sex, and the Circle. Just kind of giving a bit of a synopsis of what happens in your story.
Okay, very quickly. My story is a is really a reflection on online dating. And I started online dating as a teenager when I moved from rural Alberta to Ottawa as a teenager to go to school. So it was the first blush of online dating, and it happened through chat rooms, and I was in my late teens, and I really struggled with how to describe my body because there wasn't a language for it. Decades passed, and then I found myself single again, and online dating was still there, but it had changed dramatically. And so I reflect on what that change was like, the relationship of my body being different, and the way that it wasn't just words that gave me safety or gave me definition. It was something else. It was something a little bit more categorically inarguable, right? So I think sometimes the words that we have to use are words that not only give us comfort, but they give our potential partners comfort. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big component of the way that I saw myself, the way I described myself, the way that I sort of pitched myself to potential partners as a teenager and as an adult. And so as an adult in her late 30s, when I wasn't being seen the way that I wanted to be seen, I could take a step back and say, no, categorically, objectively, this is who I am. This has never really changed. And this is where I'm anchoring my identity. And mm-hmm. So you can use words that make you feel more comfortable, that don't unsettle your attraction to me, right? And maybe don't feel less of a man to be attracted to a woman who is big or thick or curvy or fat, but objectively, I am who I am. I am how I am, and that's never really changed over the decades. So
yes,
it was identifying that power and letting go of the worry.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think through your story, you can really see that transformation happen because you talk about some of your earlier experiences in high school, and then you mention a boy named Cade and how that was kind of a fumbling kind of, but innocent or naive, I guess, in some ways. And then you move on to Sean. And that last section, when you're talking about Sean and you say that you had been talking to your writer friends and you're sitting there with your crop top and your flowery pants and with your sunglasses. I mean, the picture in my head was just this really confident woman who was a-okay with being who she was and just presenting herself and going through what online dating, or what I guess the typical structure of an online date is, with what he says, what he's supposed to say, you're supposed to say what you're supposed to say. And then it kind of takes a bit of a turn at the end. And that comes down to words too. And one of the lines that you say, you're talking to someone afterwards and you say that he treated me like a thin woman, like someone accustomed to flattery and expecting dominance, like someone who's able to crush both those things away. Can you talk a little bit about the word beautiful and how you put that in the story?
Yeah, I have strong opinions around the word beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think for lack of a better term, and I know this is a problematic way to think about it or a problematic word to use, but I think it's kind of been weaponized in a way, at least to me, right? It carries so much power as a word, and it can only be used in specific ways to specific effects by specific kinds of people. And there isn't an equivalent way of putting a man in his place, right? I use a metaphor inside the story. I like that metaphor. I'll let the readers get to it themselves. But handsome functions differently, right? And beauty is not just about being valued and fitting in with the expectations of aesthetics and trends of the time. It's about being seen. It's about being appreciated. And it's a power that only really flows one way and functions one way. And it sometimes feels like it's a necessary thing for a romantic partner to say, like it's a claim of, I wouldn't say ownership, but it's a claim over your body, right? And it's expecting a certain reaction. And I find it really difficult to hear because I don't feel like it's always coming from the right place. And why? Why? Because it creates cognitive dissonance in the mind of a fat woman. We live in a culture that hates us. And so when you hear that word, you have to question it. Is this a legitimate sentiment, or is this something that is made to make me feel a particular way? And that's uncomfortable. And that's, I think, a reflection on like our larger relationship with forces that we don't control, but that it shows up in a very personal way. And it's difficult.
I loved when you used the term cognitive dissonance in the story, because that's exactly how I feel about it too. When someone says it, my mind immediately goes, no, I'm not. Like it's almost a visceral reaction as opposed to even a negative thought. It's almost like, no, because I don't in terms of what the society is telling us, not me. So, I when you said that and when you were talking about it, I was like, yes, I don't think anybody has ever expressed this the way you did and made me actually say that's exactly how I feel.
Mm-hmm. But it's not possible. It is not possible. I don't fit into that category. It never have. I never will.
Well, and you talk about how it is an objectification. It really is just taking the woman and looking at her as an object, as opposed to actually putting any, you know, thoughts or feelings or emotions or humanness into her. And
separating her from her selfhood.
Yes. Yeah,
absolutely. You are just an object of desire in that moment and something to be seen.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So after all that self-reflection on your past, on what it means to be beautiful, on the, you had a wonderful theme going through of different circles. How did you feel about your body after writing this story, and how do you feel about your body now?
Part of it was really interesting because I used the word fat a lot in the story, and it's a word that when I use it to describe myself, sometimes I feel like I can't claim it. Like I'm not enough. Like I'm kind of in between categories. Well, I'm fat, but I'm not that fat. Am I fat enough to like be part of the fat community? And, you know, if I use it, sometimes people who are not as engaged in those sort of conversations will say, well, no, you're not fat, you're this, you're that, you're this other thing, right? That dismissal that happens. And I think it's important that we try and continue to destigmatize and neutralize that word. It's really important. But my body has changed. My relationship with my body has changed a lot since writing that piece a couple of years ago, because I have had my chronic illness come back. My body has changed like many others during the pandemic. And so I don't necessarily feel as rah-rah about my body image. I don't feel as accepting as I would have liked to have been. And so it's a bit of a source of discomfort and a little bit of shame that I feel like I should be more, I'm truly body positive. I should be okay when I go up a few dress sizes and I put on, you know, 10 or 20 pounds, right? Due to circumstances beyond my control, like a pandemic or like health concerns. But that's not the reality of growing up encultured in a society that tells us otherwise, right? And in diet culture that is always policing our bodies, will seemingly always police our bodies. So I'm just trying to be, for lack of a better term, gentle with myself and gentle with my self-criticism, and know that it's dynamic. All of this stuff is dynamic. Bodies change, our approach to our bodies change. The ability for us to be close to our bodies and appreciate it and exercise self-love, that capacity shifts over time. It waxes and wanes. So I'm trying to think about it less and just get back to a place of small moments of joy with my body. And that's been hard when we've all been trapped inside for 15 months.
Yes. Yeah. For sure. Well, you know what? I really love that you said that. I really do, because this isn't a journey that is linear. And I think too many of us think it is, that once we understand on some type of a logical level that, you know, dieting doesn't work and that we're, you know, that our bodies are going to be changing and that it's okay for us to be larger than a size 12 or whatever, that, okay, well then that's it. We're empowered. We're good. And that isn't the reality. That isn't how it works out. And like you say, when the body starts to change, it can take us into all sorts of places. So, you know, I think it's, thank you for saying it and for going through it and just showing yourself a lot of compassion. I think that's the only way to get through it. Do you have any other tips maybe for someone who is going through the same thing you are right now?
Just look at a lot of bodies of different sizes. That's the thing that kind of got me to a place of more acceptance, was looking at a lot of bodies that were a lot more like mine. And that's a privilege of social media. That's a privilege of being in a culture that has more diversity. It's still hard to seek that out, right? You have to filter out a lot of diet culture and inspirational images and messages, especially if you're in social media. Once you do that, and once you let the good fat people in, you get sensitized to that, and it normalizes it. And for me, that was the biggest shift, and just feeling comfortable again, especially once I thought about becoming active in the dating scene. I had been with a partner for 11 years. My weight had changed quite a bit during that time. It had gone up, it had gone down. And then I was sort of at a peak when I left that relationship. I wasn't feeling particularly attractive. And I thought, you know, I'll just put myself out there and just get some reaction and just see how it goes. And to see that I was comfortable enough to do that was a source of a bit of empowerment. I read a lot of articles about women who were dating while they were fat. And that was sort of like the beginning steps of a broader journey around accepting my body for what it was. It wasn't necessarily about the external validation of having men find me attractive. That eventually happened, but it was more like, okay, you know what? You aren't as alone as when you were pioneering this 20 years ago, right? When you were a teenager, having your first dating experiences be online, facilitated through chat rooms, and just the power of the adjectives that you chose. That was really risky. That was really scary. That was really trying. But now there were so many people that were either having great times or, you know, it was part of their growth journey. I really looked to them, and it gave me the courage to try a lot of new things, not just dating, but other things with my body that I never would have thought possible. Like going to the pool, I'm like the opposite ambassador of the world. I should really be wearing a sash at all times. I love it so much. But it was very scary going to the pool in a swimsuit and seeing so many other people around me and like feeling so visible. But now it's what I crave. Like I couldn't imagine not doing it. And so I think once you get that first taste of something that feels good and affirming, keep following that path. Keep going, because there's something more for you.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That was fantastic. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for being on Fat Girl Book Club, Caroline.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Jen.
Online dating. Oh. I don't even know where to begin with this. I've had my own experiences. Let's just leave it at that. And I appreciated Caroline's openness to talk about this and her just her way of expressing what it was like in the story and in this conversation. That collection of conversations is going to stick with me. It really is. I enjoyed them so very much, and I am so very grateful to all four of these amazing authors for taking time out of their day to discuss this stuff with me. If you are interested in their work, again, please go to the show notes where I am going to have links to everything that I have got for them in terms of being able to connect with them in their work. Don't forget, too, that my online course is available and it's introductory pricing right now until the end of June. Please go check it out. It's my baby. I'm excited about it. I'm excited to talk to you about it. So if you have any questions, just please do let me know. And if this is your first time listening to this podcast, thank you for listening. And if you would like a resource, a free resource that's all around body image and how to begin to stop hating what you see in the mirror, make sure you check it out. Just go to the website, iwishiwerememe.com, and check out. There's a big pink button to get a copy of the Your Better Body Image Checklist. Completely free, and it'll give you some practical things that you can do to begin to start to change your body image. Okay, everyone, I am so excited because the next episode will be the roundtable discussion that I had with more authors from this amazing anthology. Please go and check out this book because it is really something exceptional. Keep reading, everyone.